Hello and welcome to the Mejlis Podcast, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's current affairs talk show focusing on Central Asia. I'm Bruce Panier, host of the Mejlis and author of the weekly Central Asia and Focus newsletter. Kyrgyzstan's government looks more and more like the neighboring authoritarian governments. Less than 1 year ago, the government detained more than two dozen politicians, activists, journalists, and others that authorities said were planning to foment mass unrest. The government moved against the media also, deporting one investigative journalist and suspending operations of Radio Liberty's Kyrgyz service temporarily. In the last 2 weeks, Kyrgyz authorities have moved to shut down another independent media outlet, detained a leading opposition figure who is currently a serving member of parliament and is preparing to strip the constitutional court of its powers over a ruling that supported a woman's right to give her name, not the father's, to her children. To discuss what's happening in Kyrgyzstan, I'm joined by Erica Murat, associate professor at the National Defense University in Washington, D.C., and author of many articles on Kyrgyzstan, and Suyanat Sultanaliyeva, Central Asia researcher for Kyrgyzstan and Tajikistan at Human Rights Watch. Thank you both for joining me. And let's start with you, Erica, and let's start with Kloop. What's going on with Kloop?
Effectively, the authorities are trying to shut down Kloop, one of the few, if not the only, independent outlet, media outlet in Kyrgyzstan. They started the process, started as they usually do, by filing a suit, a complaint about on Kloop, and basically signaling that they're ready to take on this fight with the media outlet that's been truly independent throughout its existence, cutting-edge reporting, investigations, and coverage of politics and just social life in Kyrgyzstan. It's a new low for Kyrgyzstan, that's for sure. That's for sure.
Okay, thank you. Suyanat, Kloop ran an article about this decision to try to shut it down, and they had some interesting comments from Emobek Abdimanapa. He is Bishkek prosecutor, excuse me. And he said that Kloop's negative reports on what was happening in Kyrgyzstan were causing, quote, has a negative emotional psychological effect on society, generating fear, anxiety, despair, and panic among a huge number of people. Also in the complaint or the application against Kloop, it said that they didn't specify that they were a media organization, even though the name of the organization is officially Kloop Media Foundation. What to make of these kind of strange and vague charges?
Yes, Bruce, thanks for having me here. And it's a really timely, important discussion. And I really liked your overview of the things that are happening in Kyrgyzstan. I mean, we all know that Kyrgyzstan has a very dynamic political landscape and, you know, socio-political landscape. But even for Kyrgyzstan, I think the way things have been going the past few weeks is just quite shocking in that sense. And even though I do agree that, you know, there has been discussions that the recent case of Azatik Media would pave the way for further attacks by the state towards other independent media. And, you know, lo and behold, we see the case against Kloop Media. And of course, the whole discussion about the sharp criticism of the government that the prosecutor, you know, cites in the request in the lawsuit, listing a number of articles, you know, and talking about hidden manipulation, dissatisfaction and distrust, which, you know, of the authorities among its readership. Apparently, the Kloop's publications inspire that in the readership. And I remember also he was saying this would also lead to their zombification, encouraging the readers to join anti-government protests. And it's just really interesting that the prosecutor doesn't seem to realize that all of these things are not criminal. All of these things are constitutionally protected rights and freedoms of people, and not just constitutional, but also by the country's international human rights obligations, right? So freedom of expression, freedom of assembly. People are free to be distrusting of the authorities, to be dissatisfied with it, to express their dissatisfaction and all of these things, to join protests. Even if they're anti-government, there is nothing that prohibits this, right? It doesn't follow that if people are coming out to express their dissatisfaction with the state of things in a country, that they necessarily will attempt a coup. which granted, okay, according to Kyrgyz laws, maybe the attempt to change the constitutional regime or overthrow the regime is punishable by law. But how do they make this jump? It's just absurd. Then again, unfortunately, as many people in Kyrgyzstan, I think, have come to develop a more pessimistic kind of a stance or even a cynical stance towards what's happening in Kyrgyzstan. And it's like really not surprising because it's just, I'm just expressing this, I guess, an overall state of mind that there won't ever be a moment when the state, the Kyrgyz government, will behave in a more logical and a rational way that's, following its own commitments before the Kyrgyz people. We're not even talking about its international commitments, which probably triggers the authorities, newfound decolonial sentiments in the authorities. But just, the commitments before the Kyrgyz people, right? It's really unclear when the Kyrgyz state is going to be doing that. So in that sense, it kind of follows that there is this lawsuit accusing Cloak Media. And then the other thing that you mentioned about the Cloak Media not being registered in the register of media organizations. But this also lacks a legal basis, at least according to the lawyer of Cloak Media, because it is a non-profit organization. According to the statute, the charter of Cloak Foundation or Cloak Media, and within the charter, it does have activities or chartered activities, which are among them providing an information platform for free expression. An information platform is exactly what Cloak is. It's a platform for people to express their opinion. And it also aims to raise awareness of youth in Kyrgyzstan on current sociopolitical, economic, and other events that are happening in Kyrgyzstan or outside of it, which is exactly also what Cloak Media is doing on its platform. So even then, there are so many legal gaps and just inconsistencies in the lawsuit that in any country where there is judicial independence and effective, rule of law, this lawsuit wouldn't stand a chance. But then again, we're in Kyrgyzstan, and it is extremely unpredictable. Sometimes it seems like the laws work, and a lot of the times it seems like they don't, or they work only when they suit somebody who stands to benefit from it, within the government, I mean.
Okay, thank you. Erica, and I'll let you answer this too, Sia, not in a minute. Erica, these charges that are against Cloak, they're based on the state-appointed experts who reviewed their material, right, and concluded also, for instance, that people were leaving the Batken province because of Cloak's negative coverage, and it was causing people to either move somewhere else in Kyrgyzstan or leave the country altogether. Have we ever had any idea who these experts are? This is not the first time they've resorted to experts to translate someone's words or and come to some conclusion about their nefarious designs.
I don't think we know who the experts are. Maybe CNN has a better understanding of who could be the actual people behind coming up with such explanations. And I want to highlight just the fact that perhaps it doesn't really matter who is behind coming up with arguments or trying to stitch together a legal case against Cloak. The big picture is that the current regime is coming up with explanations that will, on the one hand, show them as taking care of the society, of the marginalized groups, like in Batken or anywhere in the country. And on the other hand, not coming across as if they are limiting the freedom of media, freedom of speech. And of course, it works for their supporters, their loyalists, the minority of the population in Kyrgyzstan, and it doesn't stand a chance. As Sienna said, with civil society and people who really understand what freedom of speech is and civic freedoms are, the case against Cloak fits their pattern of governing for the loyal minority that elected them and ignoring the majority, and especially urban population, that disagree with them. And this pattern is seen with Klopp, with their arrest of opposition leaders, and their picking of any civic initiatives that they feel like is threatening their positions. But they're achieving just the opposite effect right now, especially with Klopp, are united behind Klopp now and voicing a joint statement against government actions. So as opposed to feeling threatened. And what they're doing, the current regime, what they're doing, they're intensifying divisions in the society and making political life in Kyrgyzstan ever more unpredictable, with more people feeling depressed about their actions and feeling like that there needs to be change and there needs to be more activism resisting onslaught of authoritarianism in the country.
Okay, thank you. Do you know who these experts are? Any idea where they come from and who finds them?
Same as Eric. I don't really know. It's never mentioned. It's like there's always reference to these experts. But it appears to me that these are people who work either. So, for example, when Parliament is passing draft laws or like considering or initiating the draft laws, they always have these court experts, I would call. So somebody who's hired and obviously is already has a conflict of interest because they are representing the side that's hired them to supposedly do the expertise. And I think it's the same case with the court cases, with the judiciary in general, judicial system in Kyrgyzstan. And there have been, I mean, I've discussed this with some human rights defenders, and they're always saying that, you know, the conclusions or like the documents, the certifications, the expertise documents that they have to deal with in these kind of cases, they just always seem extremely unprofessional, just lacking in general knowledge of the law and the sphere in which, you know, they've been attracted to for the specific case, right? So yes, I would say I'd be inclined to think that it's just, again, court experts, as in court, not as in law court, but court of the state, or like the king, the monarch, the ruling regime's experts, the court experts, in that sense. So, and I personally have no trust whatsoever in conclusions and expertise that these people provide. Yes, I mean, there would be so much more trust if the authorities sort of like try to make it at least an open call, right, for the expertise on specific cases. So there would be different kinds of opinions given on a certain issue. But that doesn't really happen.
Okay, thanks. No, that's a good idea. So I'm still amazed that the experts came up with essentially the reporting makes people feel bad. If it does, I suppose you could go to another media outlet for news if it really depressed you. But we do have to move on. Adahan Matamara, the leader of the Butun Kyrgyzstan Party, four-time presidential candidate. In fact, he ran against the incumbent, Sadır Japarov. He's a deputy, and now he's been detained. So I guess immunity for deputies is out, obviously. Sianat, I'll start with you. Can you tell us a little bit about the case of Adahan Matamara and what's going on here?
It's there's still, of course, details that need to be uncovered about the case. As usual, not a lot is available to the media. But from what we've been able to, you know, read, or I wouldn't even say ascertain, but yes, probably understand from what's already been covered about this case, is that he's being accused of high treason in relation to a 2009 protocol. It's not even an agreement. There's a huge misunderstanding where people think that it was a border talk kind of a deal, that it was a much higher level kind of a document, but apparently it was a protocol, like a working protocol that was signed between the delegates of the meeting in 2009 concerning a like no man's land, I guess, at the time. And that's the a plot of land called Turkuche in a Koktaş village in the Batken region. It's one of those areas that's been implicated. Well, not implicated. It was a place of the conflict both in 2021 and in last year's conflict in September. There have been shootouts and quite bloody. But the problem is that, and okay, so I got distracted. And the accusation is that Adahan Madumarov signed this protocol, which according to which Kyrgyzstan was taking this land, this plot of land, for lease, or was going to lease this land for 49 years. And from what I understand, this was done so that there would be, like, the Kyrgyz side would be able to construct the road that would connect Osh and Isfana, I think, or some kind of a regional road that was of regional importance. And from what I understand, this was a working solution at the time. However, what's happening right now, and it's not just that it started this year, it's some of the beginnings of this case, I think, were already last year or perhaps even in 2021. So it's been going on for quite a bit. And Madumarov is being touted as the main person behind this because he was the head of the Security Council, Kyrgyz Security Council at the time. However, if you look into this issue from the point of view of the charges presented to him, such as high treason, then one has to look further and understand that even a head of the Security Council wouldn't have the necessary authority to negotiate on behalf of the government, or of the state, right? Of the country itself. The only person who is supposedly authorized to do this kind of stuff is the president. And Alexander Madumarov, even though he's been running for presidency for four times, as you mentioned, he has never been the president. So he has never had the authority to conduct these kind of negotiations. So in that sense, again, this is of course a very political case. But again, just like I've mentioned, just like in the case with Kolp Media and many other cases in Kyrgyzstan, in a country with working rule of law, this would not, again, stand a chance as a case, as a lawsuit. However, we live in Kyrgyzstan. So what happens next is anybody's guess.
Okay, thank you. Erica, you know, Madumarov is essentially the head of the opposition faction in parliament right now, because Bütün Kyrgyzstan does have seats in parliament. And it seems a little bit ironic that he's being charged with high treason for a border deal with Tajikistan when his problems really seem to have started because of his objections to a border deal with Uzbekistan. He was very vocal last year when they were talking about the Kempirabad Reservoir. What can you tell us about, you know, what happened to him since then? I mean, he's a serving deputy. This is not just an opposition leader, but he's a serving deputy in parliament. To detain him seems a bit extreme.
So Madumarov is a populist running against populists, right? The current regime is really populist, a regime that takes on those big ideas about nationhood and justifies its autocratic and corrupt policies by presenting themselves as fighting for the nation. Same, you know, we can go back and look at how they threw out the Canadian gold mining company, how they dealt with Tajikistan and militarization of Kyrgyzstan's politics in general. So it's a pop, and Madumarov as well. He's been a politician for as long as Kyrgyzstan has been independent. He has a loyal following in his party and the parts of southern Kyrgyzstan. He is not too popular across the country. So it's a mixed bag of feelings towards him. Yeah, I completely agree with Sienna that this is, it wouldn't stand a chance in a country guided by rule of law. The case could have been a matter of public debate, national discussion, change of regulations, but it looks like it is a bit of a witch hunt or trying to clear any opposition in the parliament and trying to suppress politicians who have a strong following in different parts of the country. It's a signal to other politicians not to be vocal against the current regime. And yeah, so it's really it's a complicated political case for Kyrgyzstan, where you have an opposition leader who's been controversial himself in his own statements, his own actions, At the same time, currently being challenged by the authoritarian regime. So as much as there is sympathy and mobilization against suppression of freedom of speech and freedom of the media in Kyrgyzstan around Klop case, I don't think that Madumarov will be able to gather the same level of sympathy in the Kyrgyz public, maybe among his supporters who will try to continue to oppose his the case against him, maybe organize rallies as it usually happens with opposition leaders. But it's a slightly different dynamics than compared to what's going on with Klop.
Okay, thank you. And a reminder that we're talking about the recent crackdowns in Kyrgyzstan and the steep plummet into the abyss of authoritarianism. And my guests are Sianat Sultanaliyeva, Central Asia researcher for Kyrgyzstan and Tajikistan at Human Rights Watch, and Erica Murat, associate professor at National Defense University in Washington, D.C. Let's move on to the Constitutional Court. Today they had the first reading of the draft proposal on the Constitutional Court, which essentially strips the judges of the right to make a final decision on almost anything. It's significant that Parliament just came back into session after their summer recess. And this was, I think, the first item that they dealt with. And this all stems from a court case that was first registered a couple years ago by Altan Kapalova. And she wanted her children to have the matronymic, to have her name as part of their name instead of the father's, because she said the fathers had never had any role in their upbringing. The Constitutional Court actually ruled in favor of that, and that has led to this situation that we have now. So, Sianat, I'll start with you. What is about to change for the Constitutional Court? It's the first reading. This law passed in the first reading. There's still two more, but what happens if it passes?
Well, I guess the biggest thing that's going to happen and the most important thing that's going to happen is that previously the rulings of the Constitutional Court were irreversible or they could not be annulled. And that's in a nutshell, that's exactly what the regime is trying to change. And it's been first initiated. And as you rightfully noted, this has been just a direct reaction to the decision that was actually also a mixed victory. It wasn't a complete victory for Kapalova that allowed her, well, not allowed, like, because her children will still have to wait until they're 18 years old. But at least according to this court, the Constitutional Court's decision, anybody who's aged 18 and over would be able to change the patronymic in their passport to the matronymic name. And of course, this is, even though it is being currently tied to this very strategic, very sensitive, apparently, as it turned out, issue in the Kyrgyz public discourse. The fact that this draft law was initiated, basically amending the rights of the Constitutional Court, it's just going to destroy the Constitutional Court in general and making it subject to potential influencing by the other branches of power in the future. So there is basically no certainty in the decisions of the Constitutional Court. And as you may have been, or as some others who are listening to us have noticed, there have been not only this initiative, but also an initiative to basically discharge all of the judges at the Constitutional Court, again, specifically in relation to this decision with Altan Kapalova's case.
Okay, thank you. Erica, I'm curious, now what does this whole move do, you know, that President Japarov has billed himself as like the defender of Kyrgyz traditions? This law seems absolutely reasonable that the Constitutional Court, you know, that they upheld the right for this woman to change, use the matronymic instead of the patronymic. And yet all of a sudden it's to the level where Japarov has moved in. I mean, this is his proposal ultimately to strip the Constitutional Court really of any rights over this one issue. Right? A women's rights issue, basically. What does that say about the government?
Yeah, it says that they will continue to use the judicial system the way they want to. Constitutional Court has not necessarily been an independent court. It came as a big surprise that they ruled partially in favor of Kapalova's suit. And this was an amazing victory, even though it was partial victory, but it was an amazing victory for all women in Kyrgyzstan and men, I guess, all families, children. But it also became a lightning rod, turned into a lightning rod in the society, especially more conservative groups that they didn't like the way Constitutional Court ruled. And the regime basically leveraged that opposition in society. I'm sure they were themselves, Tashrif especially, was not pleased with the ruling. And maybe they saw it as the court not meeting the expectations of the regime and becoming too independent. So they are trying to adjust the court to their needs, like previous regimes, but they're going one step further. And it's Kapalov's case was the reason that set off this debate, but I don't think they're doing it just because of that. I think what we really need to mention in the conversation today is that the current regime wants to stay in power for as long as they can. They're clearing up the political space, be that courts, independent media, opposition voices, no matter how marginal, from criticizing them, so that they can rule for a long time beyond the current terms of power. They will continue to change the system to their needs. And unfortunately, the situation we have in Kyrgyzstan today is that the current regime is not going to leave through elections. And it will likely only give up power if things in Kyrgyzstan get really bad again and crowds assemble again in Bishkek and across the country as they did previously, to oust a corrupt, authoritarian, detached regime from power. When this will happen, we don't know, but it looks like this is another violent regime change in the making in Kyrgyzstan, unfortunately.
I tend to agree with you on that. I want to address one other thing here before we get into the final thoughts, and that's we'll go back to the media situation for just a second, but more specifically the law on foreign agent law that they're going to copy. We know that Azatik, for instance, is out of the woods. But how many other organizations, if this law, which is still on the table, right? They haven't withdrawn it, so they could still pass that at any time. What will change for the other organizations that are nominally independent in Kyrgyzstan once if this is passed? Sianat?
Just to clarify, you mentioned nominally independent, as in they are not as independent?
No. I mean, the ones that are independent. I'm thinking of Azatik, of course, first and foremost. But there's a lot of other organizations that aren't media organizations, for example.
Of course.
That are also foreign funded and work for democratic reforms and or rights, issues of rights for various groups. What happens to, so we're really not out of the woods with even that, right?
Yeah. No, we're not. I mean, in terms of the technical issues, I guess it's not going to be as difficult. Although there is, of course, going to be this sort of a threshold, right? Because all of the organizations are going to have to be re-registered, and that's the point at which the authorities might refuse registration to some of the organizations. And there are several criteria according to which they can do that, but. Provided, I personally don't think that that's going to be the case for many organizations, although I am being too optimistic in that sense. But what I think the most problematic part in this thing is that it is effectively, again, another kind of a witch hunt, as in all of the organizations would have to bear the, like, or they would be, what's the word? They would be branded as foreign representatives or foreign agents. And that's going to destroy their reputations, their outreach into the rural areas. And I'm always mentioning this in any kind of a discussion that I have, that civil society in Kyrgyzstan has already gone through so many blows to it that, compared to how things were for civil society, for activists in general, say 20 years ago, 10 years ago even, things were completely different. Things were way better. There were all kinds of activities happening in the rural areas. People were just really inspired to participate in all these events and roundtables and trainings, I don't know, whatnot, right? Whereas nowadays, there's already this atmosphere of distrust towards civil society, towards any kind of non-profit activity. And the passing of this law, the foreign representatives law, will just add into it and just kind of become the cherry on top of the processes that they have already started. And perhaps even a logical conclusion of the process that has started almost also 10 years ago. I think it was in 2014 or 13 when the first discussions started about the foreign agents law in Kyrgyzstan.
Yeah, I can't remember which one of those years it was. Erica, let me move over to you though for a second. Kyrgyzstan, once called the island of democracy. I mean, at this point, is there anything above the water? Is there any place that's safe for people that are interested in democratic reforms? Group, organization, anybody?
So I think it lost its image as an island of democracy a while ago. We call Kyrgyzstan as an isle of democracy, island of democracy, just because by habit. And thanks to its still dynamic civil society and still quite dynamic media landscape, all the laws and lawsuits and initiatives in Kyrgyzstan, they signal this notion of randomness. What dictators like to do, they will do things randomly and slowly. They suppress activism and freedoms randomly by attacking some groups while sparing other groups, but also in hopes that they will scare other groups from criticizing the regime or other politicians. We see the same patterns in Kyrgyzstan. I think that it's a temporary state for Kyrgyzstan. We had really deep dives into authoritarianism in the past as well, under Akayev, under Bakiyev, notoriously. And it's really once the society is just, especially civil society, and I'm not just talking about NGOs, I'm talking about individual activists, community groups, various grassroots organizations. They are, there's just too much of a habit of thinking and speaking independently. There is a lot of disagreement with the government. When this becomes a really big problem for the government, like it did, for instance, for Bakiyev and Akayev, and even sometimes for Atambayev, Jeenbekov, I mean, basically every single president, it's hard to predict. But the dictatorships in Kyrgyzstan survive only for so long. Give it a couple of years, who knows, maybe 5 years, maybe a year, there will be a huge backlash. And it won't necessarily come from quote unquote organized civil society. It might come from just population in general, because what autocrats in Kyrgyzstan tend to do is once they clear up the political field, then they start really doubling down in corruption and squeezing small businesses, medium businesses, just like what happened with Bakiyev. And it just becomes impossible for a regular person to survive in Kyrgyzstan. And that's when the backlash begins. So we are on this trajectory right now, again, unfortunately. But yes, this is a quite depressing time for Kyrgyzstan. It's not going to be forever like this, but it's going to get worse before it gets better.
Okay, thank you. I guess it's time we got to wrap this up for last thoughts. I'm just curious, you know, to put this in a historical perspective for Kyrgyzstan, how destructive has this government been in the last few years to the institutions in the country, you know, including the media, including civil society? I mean, you mentioned Bakiyev and Akayev, and of course, we remember the days, but it seems like this government has gone even further than them. So you're free to talk about anything you want in your last comments, but keep that at my proposal in mind too, please. Sianat, will you start?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you. Yes, I guess one thing that really stands out for me with this government is that it's gotten really specialized, I guess, because they're very skilled in rhetorics. And well, again, yes, it is a very, and I guess that's, and Erica mentioned that, it is a populist regime, probably more so than the other regimes. So it's very adept at this populist rhetoric. which is also national. It's nationalist. It's also anti-Western, anti-developmentalist logic type of stuff. I mean, I could even say that they do have some rhetoric from post-colonial or decolonial kind of discourse. And it's a really interesting mix from a very disengaged point of view. But for somebody who is living in this country and is a citizen of this country and is very like worried for the future of Kyrgyzstan, it is more than just interesting. It's very dangerous and scary how well they're able to use this, how well they're able to really manipulate the opinions of the people. Because I think we've mentioned this a few times during the call that a lot of the people actually do support. Like it is a minority, although I'm not so sure even, I don't know if I would agree it is a minority that the state is serving. Perhaps it's actually a majority now of the people in the rural areas who, and I just wanted to note on the comment on that back when Erica was talking about it, because it's exactly what the regime is doing, right? It's like divide and conquer, which again, nothing new, everybody does it. But here, especially, we're seeing that they're really playing on this rural versus urban, educated versus uneducated, or I don't know, there's also this Balkonski versus the rest of the country, or the people who live in Bishkek and the rest of the country, right? Again, nothing new, nothing unique, but this is really being blown out and being sort of like fed by the regime. So in that sense, it looks like the regime has the support, and they're playing up the nationalist populist discourse for this support, and that's what I find especially dangerous, I guess, compared to the previous regimes. But I do want to believe in this sentiment that it will get worse. It's okay. I'm okay with it getting worse as long as it will get better. So here's to hoping that it will get better.
Okay, thank you. Erica, you know, you'll remember the days when Omar Bek Tekebayev was the Speaker of Parliament and was telling then President Bakiyev he called him a dog. He said he should take advantage of the first tree that he came across to hang himself. Almazbek Atambayev was also in Parliament. He called Bakiyev a political corpse because he didn't do anything. That's gone, right? We don't hear anything like that coming out of Parliament. So I'm curious your opinion. I mean, how damaging has this been to the establishments in Kyrgyzstan?
Very damaging, very damaging. And your question about institutions, institutions are completely hollow in Kyrgyzstan. They don't really mean much. Institutions are all about loyalties, brokering different deals with the regime, with MPs and ministers constantly change depending on who is more favorable to the regime versus who is more effective. So it's the institutions don't really matter anymore, and unfortunately, the current regime's change in the parliament, that they shrank the number of MPs, is also quite damaging because it's much easier to control a smaller parliament than a parliament that is that has more voices in it and more competition. So yeah, it is pretty depressing. And I agree with what Siyanat says, that maybe we're not talking about just a minority of people supporting this regime. Maybe there is more. Maybe there is a majority, because that there is, it's a mix of authoritarianism and populism. It's a skillful narration of kleptocratic, autocratic tendencies, and mixing them up with nationalism, patriarchy, traditionalism. You name it. So it is, yeah, it is a different type of kleptocracy, autocracy in Kyrgyzstan. Hopefully at some point, people will see for what it is and, move on to greater freedoms. That's our hope, of course.
Okay, thank you. And I suppose to kind of follow up, I'll add that although Sadr Japarov won with the majority of the votes in his election, if you look at the total population of Kyrgyzstan, less than 1 in 5 Kyrgyz citizens actually cast their vote for him at the time. So there is, even if the majority is supporting him, they certainly did not at the polling booths when he was there. The majority didn't even bother to show up and cast ballots. So that's something to consider in the future, too. I'm sure we're going to get back to this topic because like I said, just in the last 10 days, so much has gone on there. They seem to be picking up speed. So, but I thank you both for being on the show. Thank you, Erica, and thank you, Sianat, for being on the program today to discuss this. A big thank you, as always, to Nathan Shoemaker, our Mejlis podcast producer in Washington, D.C. And a reminder, you can subscribe to the Mejlis podcast or Central Asia in Focus newsletter by visiting Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's website at rfarl.org. Thank you very much, and we'll be back next week. Bye-bye.